So thank you, Professor Levy Marcel, Your Majesty, Your Royal Highness, friends, colleagues, and family. I'm very pleased to be here. I'm very honored to be here. I hope to talk to you about something that is near and dear to my heart, and I hope that you will find the same. So I'm going to talk about perturbing the early life microbiome and pandemic chronic non-communicable diseases. I'm going to make it a play in four acts. And I'd like to say that it is a pleasure to be back in Holland. I have been coming here since 1957. My family made a trip to Europe on the Statendam, and our last stop was Rotterdam. We were in Rotterdam. We went to the port, which was being rebuilt after the war, and we boarded the Johan van Oldenbarnevelt, one of the old liners in the Holland-America line. And since then, I've been coming back many times with really great pleasure. So it's wonderful to be here. So I begin the play, Act One, Prologue. I begin by telling you about Piet Mondrian, one of the great Dutch artists of the 20th century, who, like Johan van Barneveld, was born in Amersfoort, coincidence. And Mondrian was interested in art expressing nature, and I hope to return to that theme. But first, I will show you a volcano erupting. And now a mountain range, and now an earthquake, and now an archipelago. And so the question is, what caused all these events to happen? Well, in the early 20th century, a German scientist named Alfred Wegener was studying fossils and studying the outlines of the continents, and he realized that the only way to explain these distributions was if there was an ancient continent where all the modern continents were connected. And he called this the Ur-continent. And he published about this in 1915. And he coined the idea of continental drifts, that the continents were in motion. But although he was correct, it was not well accepted. No one could understand the mechanism. How could continents move? But subsequently, it became clear that there is movement, that from inside the Earth, lava comes up in the middle of the ocean, it spreads the plates across, and when one plate dives under another plate, it causes volcanic eruptions and earthquakes. And also when the hotspot goes over the plate moves over a hotspot, we get archipelagos again. So the theory that developed from Wegener's observations, the theory of tectonics, explains many diverse phenomena that no one could connect before. Now I want to turn to health and medicine and tell you about something that all of you know, is that many important diseases have been increasing in recent decades. Juvenile diabetes, doubling every 20 or 25 years. Asthma, going through the roof. Diseases of the esophagus, increasing. Reflux disease, cancers of the esophagus. And many other diseases, obesity, celiac disease, autism, inflammatory bowel disease, food allergy, eczema, certain cancers. What's causing this? 10 diseases, 10 different causes, or perhaps there's a single phenomenon that's underlying them all. I want to focus first on obesity. This slide looks at obesity trends in the United States in U.S. adults. In 1989, there's no state in the United States where more than 14% of adults are obese. By 2010, there's no state with less than 20%, and the national average is 30%. What's remarkable is that it's happening everywhere, and the distance between the first map and the last map is only 21 years. Something powerful is happening. This slide looks at obesity trends among U.S. children and adolescents over about a 35-year period, and you can see which way the graph is going. Even in the youngest children, overweight and obesity is rising. And we know that obesity in children leads to obesity in adolescents and then into adults. Those are the data from the United States. But in fact, if we look at global data and we look at the rates of overweight children under the age of 5, we see the trend across the developed world, but it's also happening in the developing world. The rates are lower, but if you look where the developing world is now, it's very similar to where the developed world was 30 years ago. It suggests the same thing is happening there, but with a time lag of about 30 years. Those were the rates. What about the numbers of overweight children in the world? And here, we see that most of the overweight children in the world, under 5, are living in developing countries. And that's because that's where most of the children in the world live. And right now it's about 80%. In a few years, it'll be 90% of the overweight children in the world. So it's not just an epidemic in the United States. It is a pandemic. And so the question is, why is this pandemic happening? I would like to take us to the microbiome and remind everyone that the intestinal tract is a frontier between microbes and their hosts. In all these organs are trillions of microbes, and they're not just there passively, they are interacting with the host, and they're interacting with important parts of the host, the blood supply that goes to the liver and then to fat, the lymphoid tissue that goes to the lymph nodes and the bone marrow, the brain through the vagus nerve and hormones and neurotransmitters. This is a frontier. And as you'll see, my hypothesis, it is that changes at this frontier are what are changing these diseases. So how do we acquire a microbiome? Well, we and many others have been looking at this question. This slide is from studies we did in New York, looking at 42 healthy children at the microbes they acquire in the first 2 years of life. And what's important are not the names, but the colors. Babies begin their life with these purple bacteria, and then they're largely replaced by these light blue and the dark blue and the orange and the red. If you look at children all over the world, you see the same phenomena. This is not random. This development is conserved across of humanity. Another question is, how does a child, a baby, change their microbiome from baby to adult? So this question was addressed by Tanya Yatsenenko and colleagues in Jeff Gordon's lab. It involves the work of Rob Knight and Maria Gloria Dominguez. They studied healthy children in the U.S., Amerindians in South America, Malawians in Africa. In this graph, we're looking at age and childhood. Each circle is the composite of the gut microbiome in one individual. And this y-axis is the unifract distance between children and adults. This is an index of dissimilarity. And what the data clearly show is that when babies are born, the population structure of their microbiome is very un-adult-like. And then gradually and progressively, it gets more and more adult-like until it is. And what's remarkable here is that the age of transition is the age of 3 years. The first 3 years of life is when the microbiome is the most dynamic, when it is developing. It is also the period of time when babies are developing. They're developing their metabolism, their immunity, and their cognition. So how do they get their microbes? Well, it turns out that across the animal kingdom, mothers are important. We know that we humans are mammals. We begin life in a womb that is sterile or mostly sterile. Our first big exposure to microbes happens when the water breaks, when the baby descends through the birth canal and is covered by the mom's microbes. The baby has skin-to-skin contact with the mom. The baby's mouth, full of microbes, inoculates the breast. And now breast milk and microbes go in to form the foundation in the gastrointestinal tract. Mothers are kissing babies, licking babies, pre-masticating foods. Lots of redundant ways to transfer microbes from one generation to another. This is how it's always been. Well, we know that the external world is changing. What about the internal world? Act 2, the problem. So today, moms are not the same as they used to be. Moms are exposed to antiseptics, to antibiotics. They have antibacterials in their diet. And babies aren't the same. They may be born by cesarean section. They may miss the trip through the birth canal. Babies are bathed extensively. They're given formula, which only superficially resembles human breast milk. They get lots of medications, especially including antibiotics, which I'll talk about. So this whole intergenerational transfer has changed. Based on this, over the last 20 years, I've been developing an idea I call the theory of the disappearing microbiota. And it has two tenets. The first is that changed human ecology has altered the transmission and maintenance of ancestral microbes, which affects the composition of the microbiota. And that microbes, both good and bad, usually acquired early in life, are especially important because they affect a developmentally critical stage. That's the hypothesis. I'll show you evidence that supports this. About 10 years ago, working with Stan Falco, we enlarged this hypothesis, shown here, the effect of maternal status on the resident microbiota of the next generation. Our idea is that ancient moms had ancient microbes, which they would pass on to their children. But if they lost microbes and couldn't get them back horizontally, then the next generation would be born at a deficit, and so on and so forth. And in this model, the change in the microbiome is cumulative across generation. Each generation is getting worse. Unfortunately, there's more and more evidence that this is correct. I'll show you one example. Here we're looking at the prevalence of Helicobacter pylori in Japanese families. This is the bacteria that was the dominant organism in the human stomach until recently. And you can see how it is stepping down, just as we predicted. And there's other evidence that supports this idea. So if our microbiome is changing, what's causing it? What's leading to it? And there are many causes, but I just want to discuss one, and that's antibiotics. All of us grew up in the antibiotic era. We know of antibiotics as one of the greatest discoveries of the 20th century. It saved, since the late 1940s, it saved innumerable lives. It's revolutionized every aspect of medicine. And as a result of the professional and the public's embrace of antibiotics, we're using them more and more and more. How much more? Well, a recent survey indicated about 73 billion antibiotic doses used worldwide on an annual basis. That's 10 antibiotic pills for every man, woman, and child on Earth. The numbers are increasing. In the United States, the Center for Disease Control counted the number of courses, 262 million. That's 842 courses per 1,000 population. That's 5 courses for every 6 people year after year. Children in the first 2 years of life get nearly 3 courses of antibiotics. Children by the age of 10, about 10 courses. During pregnancy, more than 50% of pregnant women are treated with antibiotics or receive prophylaxis. This is just before the intergenerational transfer. And exposures from antibiotic use on the farm, we don't even know the scale. Now, what about in developing countries? This slide looks at antibiotic use in the first 2 years of life among urban children in 8 developing countries. This is work supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Here on the x-axis is age in the first 2 years of life by month. Here is antibiotic courses per person year. This blue line is a line I drew in. This is the rate in the United States. And in 6 of these 8 populations, the rate is higher than the United States, including in Bangladesh and in Pakistan, where the average child in the first year of life is getting more than 10 courses of antibiotics. You might ask, how is that possible? But in fact, the children have parents who love them, and they are they go to the pharmacist who's happy to sell them an antibiotic. The child has a fever. So, whoops, we are very sensitive keyboard. So everywhere we look, there's variation in antibiotic use. In Europe, there's a big north-south variation. In the United States, there's variation. The national rate in 2010 was 833 per 1,000. Northeast and Midwest, about the same. West, 638. South, 936. 50% difference in antibiotic use. No 50% difference in rate of serious bacterial infections. This reflects differences in practice and culture. So what are all these antibiotics doing? So I like to think of the ecological effects of antibiotic exposure like the proverbial iceberg. Above the water, antibiotic resistance. We've known about this since Fleming first described it in 1945. But what's below the water? What are the effects there? I believe that the main effect is antibiotics are disrupting the microbiome, and that that has clinical consequences. Those consequences may be transient or long-term. They may affect development, they may be situational, they may be senescent, they may be generational. They could involve metabolic, infectious, neoplastic, or generational problems. I'll tell you a little about each of these. First, metabolic. So here I go back to those two maps from the CDC in 2010, the geography of obesity on the left and antibiotic use on the right. And when you look at the maps, you see that there's a lot of similarity. These are observational data. They don't tell us about cause, but they are consistent with the idea that antibiotics have something to do with obesity. In fact, we know much more, because for the last 70 years, farmers have been using antibiotics to fatten up their farm animals. This is called growth promotion. The farmers have found that it works from chickens to cows, a wide swath of vertebrate evolution. It works with virtually any antibacterial that's used, regardless of its chemical structure, class, target, or spectrum. Antivirals don't work. Antifungals don't work. It's specifically antibacterials. We know that the earlier in life the antibiotics are started, the bigger the effect on growth rate, the bigger the effect on feed efficiency, the conversion of food calories into body mass. This is what farmers are trying to do, after all, bring their animals to market sooner. This suggested to us a developmental phenomenon. So we began to study this question in mice. We gave mice antibiotics or not. We looked for the properties. We looked at the microbiome. We looked for relationships. I'll show you some of these mouse experiments. Our first studies were led by Dr. Il-sung Cho. He asked, what's the effect of antibiotic exposure on body fat in mice? So he gave mice four different antibiotic regimens or not, and here we're looking at percent body fat. And those mice that got the antibiotics, they had more fat. We can see it here. This was our first evidence that antibiotics were changing metabolism in the mouse model. We learned much more from this experiment, but I'll go on to the next one. And that was work that Laurie Cox did when she was a graduate student in the lab. She asked, what's the effect of combining a high-fat diet and antibiotics? Everybody knows that obesity is due to problems in diet. So she gave mice penicillin or not. She put them all on normal chow, and then halfway through the experiment, she switched half the mice onto high-fat, high-calorie diet. Here are the results in male mice and female mice, total mass, fat mass, and lean mass. In the male mice, total mass, here's the control group, no antibiotics, normal chow. With antibiotics, they're bigger, just like on the farm. High-fat diet, bigger still. High-fat plus antibiotics, biggest. Lean mass increased like on the farm. Fat mass, big increase on high-fat diet, even more high-fat plus antibiotics. Female mice, same phenomena. The average female mouse on the high-fat diet gained 5 grams of body fat. High-fat diet plus antibiotics, 10 grams. They doubled the amount of body fat. The antibiotic potentiated the effect of the high-fat diet. Now, up to this point, the antibiotics were given for life. So we asked, what about a shorter course of antibiotics? Are the effects durable? So to the group that got no antibiotics and lifelong antibiotics, we also had 8 weeks of antibiotics or only 4 weeks of antibiotics. Here's the effect on body mass, total, lean, and fat mass. The black line is the control group. All three antibiotic groups increased total, lean, and fat mass. So 4 weeks was sufficient for the whole effect. So now let's look at what happened to the microbiome. And we're going to look at mice that are 3 weeks old. And at 3 weeks, there are only two groups of mice, control mice, and all three antibiotic groups are receiving antibiotics. This is a principal coordinates analysis that looks at the variation in the microbiome. Each circle is one mouse. Black are the control. Orange are those that received antibiotics. There's a lot of variation between the mice, and there's a lot of overlap between the two groups, but you can see that they're a little different. That's not surprising because one group is getting antibiotics, the other is not. Now we're going to go to 8 weeks. And at 8 weeks, there are three groups of mice: controls, no antibiotics, continued antibiotics, or only 4 weeks of antibiotics and then stopped. What's happening to their microbiome? Well, at 8 weeks, here are the controls in black. Continued antibiotics in orange. They're more distinct than before, not surprising. They're continuing to get antibiotics. But the group that got antibiotics and stopped, their microbiome has gone back to normal. So the effect of the antibiotic was transient, but the effect on body mass was permanent. So this indicated that perturbing the microbiome early in life can have a long-term consequence. This, I'm showing in a number of experiments. I consider this the third most important experiment. We still have second most and most important to come. So is it really the microbiome that's doing this? So we did an experiment. We transferred microbes from mice that received antibiotics or not. We sacrificed the mice, we harvested their cecum, we harvested their microbiota, and gave them to germ-free mice and watched them for 5 weeks. These mice never saw an antibiotic. Here's the effect on total lean and fat mass. The black line is the control group. What we found is that the antibiotic perturbed microbiota increased total mass. No effect on lean mass, effect on fat mass. So the microbiota was sufficient to transfer the signal. The signal is in the altered microbes. Let's turn to immunity. In these same experiments, we were asking what happens to immune cells in the intestine. Here we're focusing on a group of cells called Th17 cells. We're looking at the small intestine and the large intestine, and however we look at it, Th17 cells are down. This is a very consistent finding in our experiments. So then we asked, in the transfer experiment, what happens to Th17 and related genes? So here are the donor mice who were the source of the microbiota. As expected, they were down in all of these markers of Th17, just as we expected. What would we find in the recipients? We found the same phenomenon. So that meant that the microbiome was not only transferring the metabolic phenotype, it was transferring the immunological phenotype as well. So now let's talk about a different problem. Let's talk about role of antibiotics in infections. We know that the microbiota protects the host against invaders. What happens if we perturb it? So Claire Roubeau, who was visiting the lab from France, gave antibiotics to mice or not, looked at the microbiome, looked at resistance to infection. We looked at So our experiment is that we gave mice a pathogen of mice called Citrobacter rodentium. And the experiment is that we would give them antibiotics or not, and then one day later give them the pathogen, or 23 days later, or 80 days later. In fact, the results in one day and 23 days were striking, so I'm just going to go to 80 days. The question is, what's the effect of taking an antibiotic when they get an infection 80 days later? So here we're looking at the load of C. rodentium in the mice. The blue line is the control group. This green line is the macrolide antibiotic. There's about a one log increase, about a tenfold increase in the number of this pathogen 80 days after the antibiotic was stopped. How about weight loss? So this black line are mice that didn't get C. rodentium at all. They didn't lose weight. If they had gotten water 80 days earlier, they lost a little weight and then it came back. But if they got antibiotics, their weight fell dramatically. And quite so, in this group, we actually had to end the experiment early because they were all dying from the colitis. So it's paradoxical. We give antibiotics to treat infections, and yet there can be a late consequence, increasing susceptibility to infections. Act three, the problem worsens. So let's talk about antibiotics and cancer. And there's a lot here. I just want to show one study from investigators at the National Cancer Institute. They were looking at the rates of colon cancer in people in the United States over a 40-year period. And here are the rates by age. And if we just look at the oldest people first, people over 85, the news is very good. Colon cancer rates are falling over this 40-year period. And if you look at younger people, you see that they're falling, but as the people get younger, the rates start flattening out. And eventually, the rates are going up in very young people. We are seeing this with several cancers. Cancers are decreasing in older people and increasing in younger people. Here's a summary of those data. Here, looking at it by age, the annual percent change, here's the zero line. In people over the age of 60, the numbers are negative. Cancer rates are falling. But in people younger than 50, rates are going up. And if you ask by year of birth, you see people born early in the 20th century, rates are going down. People born late in the 20th century, rates are going up. The year at the nadir is about 1950. There's data like this for gastric cancer as well. How about antibiotics having changes across generations? So I want to talk about inflammatory bowel disease, which was recognized in the 19th century and has been increasing progressively, first in the West and now more recently in newly industrialized countries, similar to what I showed for obesity. So could antibiotics have something to do with this? Well, this is a study from Denmark where the investigators looked at all the children born in Denmark in 9 years, and they have very good records on drug use in Denmark. And they asked, is there any relationship between getting antibiotics and risk of getting inflammatory bowel disease? And what they found is yes, the more antibiotics they got, the higher the risk of developing inflammatory bowel disease. So based on this, we decided to do a study. We wanted to ask, can an antibiotic-altered microbiota affect IBD outcome in the next generation? We studied wild-type mice and a specific kind of mouse, the IL-10 resistant mouse, looking at these are mice that spontaneously develop colitis. And this is the second most important experiment I want to tell you about. So this work was done by Angel Schulfer. Thank you very much. When she was in the lab, she introduced microbiota into germ-free pregnant mice to assess the effects in the next generation. So she had germ-free mice, she mated them, now she had germ-free pregnant mice, and she gave them either normal microbiota or antibiotic-perturbed microbiota so that she could conventionalize them. She accomplished them, they're all conventionalized. The pregnant mice soon gave birth to pups, and then we followed these pups into middle age. And we asked two questions. What's the effect on the ecology of the microbiota in the mice? And what's the effects on disease? We found many effects on ecology. I'm just going to skip right and go to disease. So here we're looking at pathological slides of the colon in these 21-week-old immunodeficient mice, according to the microbiota to which their mother was exposed. Here's a pup whose mom got the normal microbiota. They have colitis. That's not surprising in these mice. But the mice whose moms got the antibiotic perturbed microbiota, they have much more colitis. In fact, when we counted, it's about 30-fold higher. There's a huge effect. It's not subtle. To summarize this experiment, I want to remind you that these pups never saw an antibiotic. Their mothers never saw an antibiotic. That means that this enhanced disease signal is entirely microbial. That means that antibiotic effects cross generations. It also means that inheritance is not just based on human genes, it's based on microbial genes as well. Act 4, hope. So we've been interested in juvenile diabetes. So Xusong Zhang has done experiments following up on earlier work where we would give mice 3 courses of antibiotics or not, and see if they get diabetes, or even just a single course and see if they get diabetes. So in these mice, or NOD mice, they spontaneously develop type 1 diabetes. Here we're looking at the rate of development of diabetes. These are the control mice in blue. Here are the mice that received antibiotics, either 1 course or 3 courses. They're getting more diabetes, so 1 course is sufficient for the full effect. Antibiotics are driving this disease in this model. We can look at the host and we can ask, how does gene expression change in this host? We're looking in the intestine of the mouse and how gene expression matures. As babies get older, some genes turn on, some genes turn off. We can measure that. So in the mouse, we found that in the time period between day 12 and 42 of life, in the controls, 127 genes changed on or off. In those that received the antibiotics, 120 genes, but they're not all the same. Some of them are the same. So these are genes whose movement is resistant to antibiotics. Here are genes whose movement was altered by antibiotics, and here are genes that moved just in the antibiotic group. We know what all of these genes are. We can organize them into pathways, and here we're looking at some of the signaling pathways involved in innate immunity. And there are many genes here, but all the genes in color are genes that have been affected by the antibiotic, either up or down. So now we come to the most important experiment. Can we reverse this? So we used our type 1 model, in which we gave mice antibiotic or not, or antibiotic, and we gave them maternal microbiota from moms to see, could we reverse this? Well, here's the Kaplan-Meier plot. So here's the control group in blue. Here's the group with antibiotics in dotted red. And here's the group antibiotics and maternal. We've almost completely reversed the effect. This means that we can reverse the altered susceptibility for disease. We can restore it. This means also that we can discover what's relevant, the taxa, the genes, the pathways, and the metabolites. We've been working on this at present, and I'll show you one result, which is this heat map, which looks at differential expression of genes in the intestine in relation to restoration. Here are all hundreds of genes we're looking at. Each line is one mouse. Red means genes are up-expressed, blue down-expressed. This is an unsupervised hierarchical clustering. We see that four mice cluster together. We see that there's a second cluster with eight mice. Turns out that these four mice, these are the mice on antibiotics. These are the control mice. And here are the mice that got the maternal. They're clustering with the controls. The antibiotic effect has been reversed. So we know what all these genes are. And this gives us avenues to approach. So I want to conclude by reminding us of the ancient, in this beautiful hall, the ancient Greek myth of Narcissus. Narcissus fell in love with his face. And ultimately, to the Greeks, he fell in love and he drowned. We want to avoid that. So let me remind you that we're losing diversity of our microbiome. And here we divide it into three locales, a developed country like the United States or the Netherlands, a developing country like India or China that started later but is catching up in a hurry, or a country that's about to develop in India or in South America or in Africa. This was the view in 2016. And the real question is, what's the future going to bring? Is the microbiome going to further decline? Are we going to be able to arrest the decline? Or are we going to be able to reverse it through restorative steps? So now I bring you back to the Dutch artist Mondrian, who had a show called The Process Works in New York in 1970. And it's kind of an illustration of how action follows ideas. From Mondrian's work, people have stylized it, and this has continued. So ideas and applications can evolve with the times. So what will the medicine of the future look like? I predict that we will be doing new analyses of child health, that doctors will examine babies and they'll examine their diapers and they'll analyze, does this baby have the personal microbes that all babies, that baby should have? Or do they have the global microbes that all babies should have? And if they don't, the doctors of the future are going to administer these microbes. And then they're going to assess for the health indicators and, if necessary, reshape the microbiome. This is what I think will be the future of pediatrics, or an important future. Also, what about adults? Can we control the collateral damage that's occurring from a changing microbiome in adults? There's evidence now that the microbiome is involved in degenerative diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and atherosclerosis, a number of particular cancers, metabolic diseases, type 2 diabetes, kidney stones, and infections. This is a frontier as well. Can we harness the microbiome to prevent or treat these illnesses? And I think my colleague, Professor Neubendorf, will be talking about this extensively. Where will we get these microbes from? Well, Maria Gloria Dominguez, who's here tonight, my wife, has started a nonprofit, the Microbiota Vault, a global nonprofit to conserve long-term health. We want to store the microbes from developing countries so that we will have something to give back to future generations, modeled after the seed vault. You can see our paper in Science or go to our website. Finally, we go back to Mondrian. One of his famous paintings reminds me of New York. He lived in New York until he died in New York. He died of pneumonia in 1944, just as antibiotics were starting. But they didn't come online early enough to save him. So maybe we can conclude from that modern medicine has given us much, but there have been unintended consequences. But with proper attention, we can fix it. Many people did the work I talked about today. I've highlighted those who did the most work, lots of others, many funding sources. I'll mention the Foundation LEDUC, which brought Max Neubendorf and myself together, working together on a project. For those who are interested, I've written about this a number of years ago. It's translated into Dutch. You can see that everyone is reading it. Thank you very much for your attention.